Sunny skies at 74 degrees. Welcome to this Friday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. And of course, we begin with the latest regarding Georgia's preparation for Hurricane Irma. Today, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal, as well as other officials, laid out the state's plan. Now, we have a lot to get to regarding Irma, so I'm joined by my colleague, Dennis O'Hara, from Morning Edition. Dennis, thanks for pulling double duty.
Hey, Rose.
Good to have you back.
Good to be back.
So let's begin with Governor Deal outlining the mandatory evacuations.
It also declares a mandatory evacuation of all areas that are east of Interstate 95, all of Chatham County, and some areas that are actually west of Interstate 95 that will be potentially affected by storm surge. That mandatory evacuation will go into effect tomorrow, that is Saturday, September the 9th, at 8 o'clock a.m.
And Governor Deal added, it's not just coastal residents. He says all Georgia residents should take some precautions now.
Just because the weather now may appear to be calm, do not take that for granted. This is a rapidly moving hurricane, and the weather and the consequences of that hurricane can change dramatically.
As for evacuees from Florida, Georgia Emergency Management Agency Director Homer Bryson said there are plans for them and Georgia residents needing emergency shelter.
Evacuees out of Florida travel further into North Georgia to seek sheltering. We're working to open shelters now. So we have shelters open today. The goal is to have over 50 shelters open and available tomorrow with over 7,000 beds. We want to keep the shelters in South Georgia available for our local citizens as they're needed.
And there are routing changes for the interstates that serve the Savannah area. Here's Georgia Department of Transportation Commissioner Russell McMurray.
Tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., we will contraflow I-16. So let me explain what that is. So all the lanes that head towards Savannah from Dublin to Savannah will be reversed so that the only direction of travel will be from Savannah to the west, which is toward Macon, 125 miles up to Dublin, Georgia.
And taking a lesson from Hurricane Harvey, Georgia Department of Public Safety's Colonel Mark Madonna is telling motorists to think and then think safety first.
If you find yourself traveling in hazardous conditions where there's a lot of rain, what did Texas and Harvey show us? Do not drive into standing or moving water. The majority of the fatalities that occurred in that state related to traffic during the incident was people driving into water.
And finally, Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr warned merchants against raising prices on vital supplies during this time.
Price gouging protections are in place, and what that means is you cannot charge, generally speaking, more for a product or service that's protected, that's covered prior to or after the state of emergency that you were charging prior to it as well. You know, this is a time where we've got to come together and help one another, not take advantage of one another.
Now, as for the latest on Hurricane Irma, it has been downgraded to a Category 4, but meteorologist Sid King with the National Weather Service in Peachtree City says, don't be fooled, it's still a powerful storm.
It's a higher-end Category 4 storm, but it's still an extremely dangerous storm with a very large wind field. So it is, although it has downgraded, it's still a very dangerous situation.
And as for the timing of this, King says Irma is expected to start by hitting the Florida Keys this weekend.
Right now, the time of arrival based on the current track is going to be early Sunday morning, between about 2 and 5 a.m. on Sunday morning is when it will hit the Florida Keys.
And what can we expect in the Atlanta area?
Right now, Atlanta is in the path of the storm. It looks like it will weaken as it passes over the Florida Peninsula and into the Georgia area. So right now the timing for that area would be late Monday night, early Monday morning, that it would begin to impact central Georgia.
Now, weather forecasters say Irma's really a unique system, so it's difficult to determine whether severe storms like this current one will become more common. But King says it's possible that systems could develop beyond the typical hurricane season.
In 2005, even, we had storms forming in December and January, I believe. So even though November 30th is the last official day, there could still be activity after that.
Well, speaking of activity, nearly 600 college students from SCAD Savannah were bused to Atlanta on Thursday. They're settling into temporary dorms here in Atlanta. Jason Collins is one of about those 600 students who took the SCAD bus to the area.
So I brought with me money, identification just in case, and just like a few clothes because I don't know how long I was going to be here. So just the essentials to survive. Not enough clothes.
The university confirmed there are no students on campus or in the dorms on the Savannah campus. Classes in Atlanta and Savannah were canceled for Friday and Monday.
Now, before this edition of Closer Look wraps up, we'll air all of this again in case you missed any of it. All the precautions and suggestions from state officials, as well as the path of Irma. Dennis, thanks for coming up. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Rose.
Closer Look continues. We're back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from Reliable Heating and Air, a Trane dealer, a family company since 1978 offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at ReliableAir.com. And from Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater Company, presenting Holler If You Hear Me, a fable about the urban realities of life told by the poetry and lyrics of Tupac Shakur. Open September 12th, TrueColorsTheater.org.
Tonight at 7 on PBA 30, the body of a man is found in a locked room, and Father Brown suspects that he's been poisoned. Based on the short stories by J.K. Chesterton, Father Brown follows a kindly cleric as he solves mysteries in the sleepy Cotswold village of Kimbleford. Watch Father Brown tonight at 7 on PBA 30.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email at rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
My name is Will, and I live in Decatur. I would say it's like a university town, but with adults, more adults. I like that it's close to Atlanta, but it's also its own kind of town. Well, I like downtown Decatur. It's easier to walk around. It's less spread out. Not really wild about the strip mall parts of like Lawrenceville Highway and North Druid Hills. Like the traffic's really bad and I don't know how many more McDonald's we need.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. As Hurricane Irma approaches the coast of Florida, we'll have the latest forecasts and check in along the Florida coast where evacuations are underway. And where might Irma head next? Georgia and the Carolinas are preparing. Our continuing coverage of Hurricane Irma, that's next time on Here and Now. This afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
Thank you. And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. And a reminder, we'll have much more on Hurricane Irma and Georgia's preparation before the end of today's program. As you know, this week we've also been discussing the president's decision to rescind the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA. It was implemented under President Barack Obama, and nearly 800,000 immigrants were approved through the program. Now, they were illegally brought to the United States as children. Here in Atlanta, Freedom University was founded by undocumented students and before the DACA policy even took effect. Earlier this week, I spoke to Alma, a local teacher who's a beneficiary of DACA and a current student at Freedom University. Alma told me she is hopeful a more permanent pathway to legal immigration will someday happen.
It's going to be a long road to get to where we want to get because we no longer want temporary statuses. We want a permanent solution. And I'm not sure if that's going to happen in the next 6 months. I'm not sure if that's going to happen in the next 6 years. But that's what we're going for.
In response to President Trump rescinding the DACA program here in Atlanta, the city council passed a resolution that would protect the rights of immigrants. Councilmember Kwanzaa Hall introduced the resolution. He joins me in studio, as well as Azadeh Shashani, Legal Advocacy Director of Project South, a social justice and human rights organization. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Councilman Hall, let me start with you. Why the need to introduce this resolution after President Trump's announcement on DACA?
Well, you know, the city has always been a welcoming place, and that's a part of our southern hospitality, but we're also a city of dreamers. And to even think that we would not want to try to speak out and reaffirm the practices that we have been adhering to for quite some time was something that I thought, in working with my staff and my colleagues, we should really step up on. And we were able to get it passed, and I think all in all, really, it's just sending the message that at the local level, we're going to lead and we're going to do what we believe is right by people, those who are most vulnerable, those who have been in the margins.
You know, Councilmember Hall, part of this resolution has a provision that calls for the police department to limit cooperation with federal immigration officials. Define what you say limit when you say limit. Define what you mean when you say limit cooperation.
It just refers specifically to judicial versus non-judicial warrants. And we're trying to ask that if it's not a judicial warrant, that there's no direct interaction with ICE. Because a detainer really is something that it's just a request. It's mm-hmm. not an official document. And that could be very subjective and arbitrary. You could be discriminating. And actually, it is discrimination. And our Constitution says we're not supposed to do that, and we want to reaffirm Atlanta has not generally been practicing that, but it hasn't been written anywhere. We tried to do an ordinance a few months ago when we were dealing with things at the airport, but at least a resolution gives the council a place to stand on this. And I think the administration has been working very closely with the police department and chief to make sure that we're acting that way, but you just got to send that message sometimes.
Well, that was my next question. Did you discuss all this with APD Chief Erica Shields?
Well, it's been a conversation that we've been having for quite some time, and sometimes you just don't have the ability to make all the extra connection points when you're in the heat of the moment in a council meeting. We had a lot of other things going on. We did debate it a little bit on the floor. We talked to the legal department. And in fact, actually, some of the conversation really would be with corrections more so than it is with police department. But I think the spirit of our city is really one of welcome. And as a council member, and I have the ability to legislate, and that's what I chose to do.
You mentioned the word welcome because Atlanta has adopted the term welcoming city, not a sanctuary city. There's a difference there.
Yes.
Have you all talked about adopting the term and being a, quote, sanctuary city?
You know, Atlanta's very unique in that there are interesting relationships we have because of the airport, because of the things that come through our city. We're a capital city in a way that many other cities are not. And our relationships across partisan lines are very strong, whether it be at the state and in some cases it has been at the federal level. At least there's no direct conflict. So why would we want to start a fight that we don't have to be in, because Atlanta does not generally practice going after anyone because they look like they're an immigrant. If we did that, and if we were in that posture, I think we would have to call for a higher order, but that's not the way our administration has been leading. The previous chief nor this chief have gone after people because they happen to look different from whatever is considered to be an Atlantan or American.
But while the city does not have that practice. You are saying, though, that if there ever was any situations where ICE would need to detain someone who was in custody of the Atlanta Police Department, you would not give them the authority to take that individual. Is that what you're saying?
Unless it's a situation where it's a judicial scenario. And that's a judicial warrant. If a judge says this is a real situation and we need to go after this person, there are people who are doing bad things. And they're American citizens. And in other cases, they may happen to be folks who are undocumented. You have both cases. But if it's a warrant that's officially given by a judge, then I think there's no problem with us cooperating. But in other cases, it's just someone kind of going around with a request saying, mm-hmm. we think there are some folks there. And that's what's happening primarily in the suburbs, not in the city of Atlanta.
And you want to make sure it doesn't happen.
It doesn't ever happen by mistake.
Azadeh, let me bring you to the conversation. You are supportive of this resolution that also vows to, quote, protect immigrant rights. What provision or provisions of this resolution give you confidence that the city of Atlanta will do just that?
Right. Thank you very much for having us. So the provision that Councilmember Kwanza Hall just talked about, really making it clear that unless there's a judicial warrant, the City of Atlanta Police Department or Corrections Department has no authority to prolong the detention of anyone who's in local custody and is already eligible for release. Meaning that if the person has already paid bond or, you know, if they had a sentence, they've already served their sentence, just because of the fact that ICE issues a detainer doesn't give the City of Atlanta authority to continue to hold them for ICE. And I should mention that the City of Atlanta, in passing this resolution, stands on a strong legal and constitutional grounds. There are five other localities in Georgia that have already passed similar policies and hundreds of localities across the nation that have passed such policies.
Let's talk about DACA, your reaction to what happened this week.
It's unconscionable. It's really a cruel act mm-hmm. on the part of this administration to really withdraw protections from students, from youth who have contributed so much to this country and to this community. You know, we will continue to fight. We're calling on Congress now to adopt legislation to protect not only Dreamers, but undocumented immigrants who are members of our communities, who are our neighbors, and who are contributing to our community and up to our economy.
Council Member Hall, let me ask you this. If President Trump had not made the announcement, although for a long time it was felt it was coming that he was going to rescind DACA, would you all have passed his resolution? Why haven't you done it before?
Well, actually, I did bring up a similar version. It was an ordinance back in April, and we got so much pushback from a legal standpoint, and maybe it was a little bit stronger language, even stronger than what we introduced.
Like what?
It might have created more jeopardy related to some of the funding streams, and my colleagues, as well as the legal department and the administration, just felt like it was going to take more work to go into it and to try to get it passed, and I think something else came up at the time, but we also just wanted to send the message that this matters, help us figure it out. And there has been work behind the scenes with the Welcome Atlanta office on strengthening our position and still being the open city that we know we are, because that's really what our intent has always been. But if there's a way to make it legal and strengthen our police department to give them protection but not to be in conflict with the federal government in other categories of funding, that's our goal. And let me just say, the other jurisdictions have been in this posture since 2014 in some mm-hmm. cases. Fulton County, Clayton County, DeKalb County, Fayette County, and only Clarkston 2017. So I think it's already been in place, but it's from the sheriff's perspective.
Can you understand the counterargument that this is just a resolution? You mentioned that before you were worried about whether or not it would pass, quote, legal muster. What guarantees do you have that this can stand up to any type of legal opposition?
Well, the good thing is that the will of our city, and there's a lot of power in of course, the mayor's office and the chief's office. They have day-to-day responsibility. And as a legislator, we can at least say this is as a governing body, we'd like to see you take this posture and reaffirm the posture and raise the bar. And if we could pass an ordinance, which we might be able to do, It just requires a lot more work. We'll have to get some of our Legal Eagle friends who are willing to offer pro bono support. And I'm willing to use this as a Trojan horse, if you will, to open that door to see what else we can do that would be unique and special to Atlanta.
Well, it's not a surprise to anyone in this room, but there's not much time in terms of for this current administration. So
yeah, I mean, but we're getting a lot of stuff done. And we passed this in one day, so who knows what we might be able to figure out in the next 2 weeks. So there is an urgency, and when you have urgency in anybody, any organization or structure, things tend to get done faster. So let's see if we can use this momentum to change how Atlanta addresses the immigrant population that we so love and are in District 2 in particular. The Dreamers are at Freedom University mm-hmm. at the site of Dr. King's legacy, where we're celebrating Ebenezer Church. I mean, how could we not?
As we wrap up, Azadeh and Councilmember Hall, what is your message to DACA recipients in the city? Azadeh, I'll start with you.
That we are with you. We are united in this struggle, and we're going to continue to work towards the passage of legislation at the congressional level to protect the rights of Dreamers and all immigrant communities.
Councilmember Hall.
We stand with you. Atlanta is with you. And we will do everything in our power to continue to protect the rights that you are inherently due. Our country was founded by people or built by people who came from all walks of life, and many were undocumented in so many different shapes, forms, or fashion, but they made our country the great place that we say it is. They did the same for our city. So just know that you have a partner in the city of Atlanta, and me as your council member, but I think also my other colleagues as well, and the mayor.
All right, Atlanta City Councilman Kwanzaa Hall, Azadeh Shoshani, Legal Advocacy Director of Project South. We've been talking about the city's new resolution that protects immigrant rights, at the same time opposing President Trump's decision to rescind DACA. Thank you both for coming in and taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Support for WABE comes from Comcast Business. Comcast is building a gig speed network providing small businesses across the country with the opportunity to dream gig. Learn more at dreamgig.com. Comcast Business, built for business.
When you're catching up on the day's news, the headlines are a good place to start. But to really understand the world and what's happening, you want the full story. All Things Considered takes the time to explore the details and differences to find meaning in the day's biggest stories. Stand with the facts. Listen every day. Join us weekday afternoons from 4 until 6:30 for All Things Considered here on 90.1 WABE.
Community issues are what drives the conversations here on Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Tell me what's happening where you live. Send an email to rose@wabe.org. Again, that's rose@wabe.org. This is member support at 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
My name is Ann Nguyen, and I live in Stone Mountain. I like the shops. I like artists from there. I like the attractions and Stone Mountain Park. They have activities for kids. You know, they can practice and familiarize themselves with art, like pottery, painting. If I could change one thing about Stone Mountain, it would be traffic jam. It's really bad there.
On the next Fresh Air, Pamela Adlon. Her semi-autobiographical FX series, Better Things, begins its second season next week. She plays an actress and voiceover artist who's a single mother of three girls.
You're my mom! I want you to know if I have sex or if I want to get high.
Ah! No, hide things from me, please.
Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. I'm Rose Scott. Time now to talk about a potential breakthrough treatment for the medical world. At least 52,000 people die of traumatic brain injuries in the U.S. Now, that's according to the traumatic brain injury research by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. To help treat some of the brain injuries, possibly, researchers at the University of Georgia have developed a hydrogel treatment called brain glue. So we're going to find out more. And I'm joined now by the lead researcher, Dr. Loitash Karumbia, hope I got that right, is an associate professor and assistant professor of regenerative medicine, Regenerative Bioscience Center at the University of Georgia. That's a lot that you're involved with. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin here. When we talk about brain injuries, that's a broad umbrella term. Can you cite some examples of types of brain injuries we're talking about here?
Sure. So we define brain injuries as anything that affects the brain and that can affect a person's ability to move or think or remember things and such. But the spectrum of injuries is really wide, and people classify these injuries as being either mild, moderate, or severe. But these are, again, pretty broad terms, and there's always some degree of overlap between these situations. But the one thing that connects, I guess, all of these injuries is that there are no real treatments mm-hmm. for traumatic brain injuries. And a number of these situations really manifest over years. People that have severe brain injuries can succumb to mm-hmm. death, can have severe long-term disabilities. And there's no real treatments to treat TBI, and that's really a constant theme across these different situations.
You know, the brain is often referred to as the command center for our nervous system. So anytime there is an injury to that organ, as you just talked about, it is critical, typically. And when you think about where we are today, have we made any progress in treating brain injuries?
I think at the in the clinic, people, clinicians and the technology has really advanced into providing the kind of critical care that patients need after they sustain these severe injuries. And I think a lot of advancement has been made at the emergency level where people are stabilized acutely, they're resuscitated, and a lot of emphasis is paid to keeping these patients alive when they sustain these severe injuries. And I'm talking about the other side or the mm-hmm. extreme spectrum of these traumatic brain injuries here.
Is surgery typically, I guess, the best result when you talk about these brain injuries? Is it surgery that's typically needed?
Yeah, I think it's situational. So if you take someone like Michael Schumacher, who was the Formula One driver, mm-hmm. Had a skiing accident, had his helmet on, and all the protective gear that could potentially protect him from these from the severe injury, and yet he had a severe internal mm-hmm. brain injury that needed what we call a craniotomy or the excision of the skull to expose the brain and to relieve that pressure that kind of builds up that can eventually push a person into a coma and lead to death. Mm-hmm. So it's really a preventative measure that's taken at the surgical level to give the brain time and the space to expand and hopefully go back into where the swelling is not critical. And that's really a protective kind of a surgical measure that people take or the surgeons take.
Let's talk about this brain glue because there are a lot of images that come to mind. So right. Exactly what is it?
Yeah, so I guess we're pretty early mm-hmm. in the stage of the technology. So it's I'd like to put it out there that we're nowhere near a clinical application of this technology, and that's important to note. But I think what we're targeting is really the extreme or the severe side of these traumatic brain injuries, where there's a lot of necrosis or death of the tissue and damage of the tissue. And typically what's done is that this tissue is removed mm-hmm. At the surgical time point. And after these procedures, a patient is really subject to aggressive rehabilitation after a period of time of stabilization of the patient and so on. But there's no real treatment. Mm-hmm. And eventually what happens is that you have this big hole or this big void
where the tissue
in the brain,
used to be.
Where the tissue used to be. And how people cope is that the brain has this tremendous ability to heal over time. And there's some level of functionality that returns because of this aggressive rehab that the patients are subject to over time. And the brain does tend to heal, but in a lot of instances, a number of these people are wheelchair bound. They have severe long-term disabilities. The cost of care of these individuals is really high, and so it's a real problem.
This connective tissue that you've talked about that's typically removed, is that what the brain glue would either replace or become a substitute or alternative?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so what we think about when we think of the brain glue as we've devised it is really a scaffold. So if you think about a building, you really need this framework first to begin to put on the structural elements that would make up this building. And I think the brain glue is essentially that. It serves as that support structure initially to keep together a number of these brain's protective factors and enable the rehabilitation of the brain tissue itself.
What's the chemical composition of this brain glue?
That's a great question. So
I've got two great questions in a row. I'm so excited.
So the brain glue is essentially made of a couple of elements that are native to the brain. So the brain is this jelly-like organ, and it's encased within this hard shell. And it's really made of mainly sugars and fats. And there's a few proteins in there that the cells need to kind of make these brain cell networks that make us all function. So we've taken these sugars and constructed this brain glue out of there because it has a number of attractive elements to attract these protective factors, the reparative and regenerative cells within the brain to then begin this regenerative process that would help keep brain tissue from degrading over time.
You know, the human body has its natural way of rejecting treatments and all other kinds of application. And I know you mentioned you're nowhere near any clinical application, but is there any way to determine whether or not that could happen with the brain glue and the body rejecting it?
Absolutely. I think rejection is always a concern. And I think some of the things that we are trying to do now, so the brain glue that we're working with right now is in preclinical sort of studies. So we're doing a number of these experiments in rodents, and we hope to take this into a large animal model with my colleague Frank West at the University of Georgia and Steve Stice. And these are kind of the preclinical studies that we'd like to do to see whether these are real problems. And we should be able to get some inkling of whether or not rejection is a real problem. And those would be the kinds of studies that we do.
And how long before you move from rodents and large mammals to possibly humans?
Yeah, that's a tough one. And right now we're trying to get some of these studies in place so that we get some information on what it is that we think the brain glue is and isn't capable of. And once we do that, I think we're working really hard with the University of Georgia's Technology Commercialization Office to plan a path to clinical kind of applications in the distant future.
And that's not an easy process to get clearance for that when you go from rodents and large mammals to humans. So could it be a few years?
It could be a few years or longer. Someone like Steve Stice at the University of Georgia has a lot of experience with commercializing these technologies, and those are the kinds of resources that we'd leverage to really take us to the clinic ultimately.
How long have y'all been working on this?
So this has been something that I started off doing at Georgia Tech when I was a research scientist at Ravi Belamkonda's lab there. And the idea really spawned from this observation that a number of these sugars that I spoke about had different effects on brain cells. And some of them had good effects, some of them had not so good effects. And so we thought about taking some of these sugars that had great sort of outcomes with these brain cells in a dish and thought about making a material out of it to substitute brain tissue after a traumatic brain injury. And this work was really done at the University of Georgia. So it's about 5 years in the making.
And nowhere else in the world are they working on this? You all have sort of pioneered this.
Well, I think there's a number of people trying to do these sorts of studies. But I think the roadblocks that a number of these studies face are that the materials and the strategies that people use aren't really integrative, and the brain really doesn't have the mechanisms to use those materials to preserve tissue or to repair and regenerate. So in that context, I think we have a slightly better chance of success than most, maybe.
Speaking of success, I'm going to ask you to look into your research crystal ball and somewhere down the road, how everything going accordingly, how effective do you think this brain glue will be in treating traumatic brain injuries?
Exactly. So I think that's the ultimate goal, is to really take something that we've started to see great results with and see it translate into the clinic. So I would, if I had to look forward, 5 years and see how this would really help people with severe traumatic brain injuries, is for this to be really a tissue replacement kind of a material that we can infuse into a lesion or a void that a person has after years of having a traumatic brain injury, and that can really benefit his functional capabilities and cognitive capabilities and such. So that's really the ultimate goal.
That'll be a remarkable goal. Dr. Lohitash Karumbaya, Assistant Professor of Regenerative Medicine, Regenerative Bioscience Center at the University of Georgia. We've been talking about brain glue and what it could mean in the future for treating traumatic brain injuries. Doctor, thank you so much for coming up to Atlanta. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email, rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
My name is Emily Tomlinson, and I am from Vine City. I study drawing and painting at Georgia State University. I really like living in Vine City because it's really close to public transportation, as well as Georgia State, where I take classes. The growth of gentrification in the area. It's taking a lot of people out of the city, where a lot of their family is from. With the dome and everything. It's very authentic Atlanta. It's, I think, one of the oldest neighborhoods in Atlanta, and it brings a lot of diversity to the city.
Dentists have played a role in the opioid crisis.
I have dentures, and I went to have some legitimate work done, and I got some Percocets, and I realized that by going to another dentist, I could get some more Percocets.
In Massachusetts, dental schools are working to fix that problem. That story, plus the latest on Hurricane Irma, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News. From 4 to 6:30 on 90.1 WABE.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. I'm Rose Scott. As we mentioned earlier in the program, Georgia is preparing for Hurricane Irma. Today, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal, as well as other state officials, laid out the state's plan. We'll get to that in just a moment. But this from the White House: President Donald Trump has approved Georgia's emergency declaration. Now, what this means is that the White House is recognizing that there is an emergency that exists in the state of Georgia, which also means there could be federal assistance to help supplement state and local response efforts due to the emergency conditions. Now, earlier today, Governor Nathan Deal and those other state officials pretty much gave out a very detailed plan. Here's Governor Deal outlining the mandatory evacuations.
It also declares a mandatory evacuation of all areas
that are east of I-Interstate 95, in all of Chatham County, and some areas that are actually west of Interstate 95 that will be potentially affected by storm surge. That mandatory evacuation will go into effect tomorrow, that is Saturday, September the 9th, at 8 o'clock a.m.
Now, Governor Deal stressed that all Georgia residents should take precautions.
Just because the weather now may appear to be calm, do not take that for granted. This is a rapidly moving hurricane, and the weather and the consequences of that hurricane can change dramatically.
And as you know, residents of Florida have been evacuating. Some are heading to this area. Georgia Emergency Management Agency Director Homer Bryson said there are plans for those evacuees from Florida, as well as Georgia residents needing emergency shelter.
Evacuees out of Florida travel further into North Georgia to seek sheltering. We're working to open shelters now. So we have shelters open today. The goal is to have over 50 shelters open and available tomorrow with over 7,000 beds. We want to keep the shelters in South Georgia available for our local citizens as they're needed.
And there are some interstate routing changes for the Savannah area. Here's Georgia Department of Transportation Commissioner Russell McMurray.
Tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., we will contraflow I-16. So let me explain what that is. So all the lanes that head towards Savannah, from Dublin to Savannah, will be reversed so that the only direction of travel will be from Savannah to the west, which is toward Macon, 125 miles up to Dublin, Georgia.
And Georgia Department of Public Safety's Colonel Mark Madonna is telling motorists to not only think, but think safety first.
If you find yourself traveling in hazardous conditions where there's a lot of rain, what did Texas and Harvey show us? Do not drive into standing or moving water. The majority of the fatalities that occurred in that state related to traffic during the incident was people driving into water.
And Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr is warning merchants, don't do it, against raising prices during this time.
Price gouging protections are in place, and what that means is you cannot charge, generally speaking, more for a product or service that's protected, that's covered. Prior to or after the state of emergency that you were charging prior to it as well. You know, this is a time where we've got to come together and help one another, not take advantage of one another.
Now, as for the latest on Hurricane Irma, it has been downgraded to a Category 4. But meteorologist Sid King with the National Weather Service in Peachtree City says, don't be fooled, folks. This is a powerful storm.
It's a higher-end Category 4 storm, but it's still an extremely dangerous storm with a very large wind field. So it is, although it has downgraded, is still a very dangerous situation.
Now he adds that the Florida Keys can expect to hit, the Florida Keys will hear about this weekend.
Right now, the time of arrival based on the current track is going to be early Sunday morning, between about 2 and 5 a.m. on Sunday morning is when it will hit the Florida Keys.
And as far as what we can expect in the Atlanta area?
Right now, Atlanta is in the path of the storm. It looks like it will weaken as it passes over the Florida Peninsula and into the Georgia area. So right now, the timing for that area would be late Monday night, early Monday morning, that it would begin to impact central Georgia.
Weather forecasters say Irma is a unique system, and it's difficult to determine whether severe storms like this current one will become more common. But King says it's possible that systems could develop beyond that typical hurricane season.
In 2005, even, we had storms forming in December and January, I believe. So even though November 30th is the last official day, there could still be activity after that.
And we'll have more on Hurricane Irma throughout the afternoon here on 90.1 WABE. This is Closer Look. If you missed any part of today's show, we got you. You can catch up on all the interviews you missed at wabe.org/closerlook. And let me know what you think. Tweet me at WABE Rose Scott or send an email to rose@wabe.org. This is member support at 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
does Middle America have to do to breathe some new life into a shrinking small town economy, huh?
Unlike a lot of small rural communities that are losing population, we're going to be here 50 years from now.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Immigration might be the answer. Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.1 WABE.
Kai Rizdal, still in our Closer Look bumper music. Send him an email. This is Closer Look here on 90.1 WAB, Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. We've heard how Georgia officials are preparing for the remnants of Hurricane Irma, but we want to check in on Florida. Joining me on the line from NPR member station WGCU of Florida Gulf Coast University is reporter Quincy Walters. Quincy, thanks for making time for Closer Look.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Let's begin here, Quincy. Where exactly are you?
So right now I'm in Fort Myers. It's in southwest Florida between Tampa and Miami.
And in terms of being in Irma's pathway, what's the projected impact? What are you all looking at?
So we just got done with an interview with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network's meteorologist Jeff Huffman, and he says that the cone of uncertainty is wider than the peninsula of Florida. So right now it's maybe too soon to tell where it's going to exactly impact, but no matter where it does, Floridians are going to feel it no matter what.
And I understand there's a mandatory evacuation order in place for pretty much the entire area.
Right. So right now there's a mandatory evacuation in effect for the barrier islands, which include Bonita Beach, Fort Myers Beach, Sanibel, Captiva, and Pine Island. And there's a mandatory evacuation for mobile and manufactured homes right now. But I've been going to press conferences at the Lee County Emergency Operations Center. And while there isn't a blanketed mandatory evacuation, the message was to get out now. And right now I'm kind of hearing that starting tomorrow it's going to be too late to leave.
And what about the university there? Any other colleges in the surrounding areas?
Right. So Florida Gulf Coast University is closed. Got an email earlier today that it'll be closed on Monday as well. It's a ghost town. Florida Southwest is also closed.
Now, you have been covering all of this. You've been going to press conferences. You went to a press conference earlier today with the Lee County Sheriff's Department. What was that about? And you also have some sound for us as well.
Right. So Tony Shull with the Lee County Sheriff's Department was talking about the sheriff's going door to door to the barrier islands, encouraging people to get out. And he says they can't force people to leave, but he wants people to know that if you don't leave when the conditions deteriorate, emergency services won't be able to get to you.
Make sure you have a plan. If you stay, make sure you notify friends and relatives that you are there. Right now, it's just a matter of getting the word out and making sure people understand. We are stressing that if at all possible, they do leave, they do evacuate, letting them know that emergency services, when the conditions deteriorate, are not going to be available for them at that point.
Quincy, it's not mandatory, but are there people around?
Yeah, so there are people around. Actually, on the way to the press conference, it's still kind of bustling in Fort Myers, although you can kind of see the effects of concerns when you go into stores and when you go into or when you try to get gas. On Wednesday, it took me about an hour to find gas. The lines are usually long, but I guess on any given day that's a bad thing, but long lines at a gas station means there's gas. And I went to the store last night to get some last-minute supplies, and the only canned meat there was caviar, and the only water there was Perrier. And the section for the life vest, it looked like it was ransacked. So even if people are still here, they're getting ready for this.
And Quincy, as I mentioned, you've been out already this morning. Where did you go, and who did you talk to?
Right, so there's a mandatory evacuation for mobile and manufactured homes. This morning I went to an RV and trailer park, and I spoke to a little six-year-old boy named Axel Jose Antonio. He had his teddy bear while his mom and sister were packing up the car with water jugs.
I'm not staying here. I'm just going to go somewhere else. I'm just going to go with my mom, sister, and brother. I don't know what was that.
I think that was a car accident.
Wow. So while you were talking to this, sounds like a very sweet little boy, there was a car accident?
Right, correct. So this was a few minutes after the mandatory evacuation was in effect for the mobile and manufactured homes. And at the there's a big light post at the entrance of this neighborhood, and someone crashed into it.
Quincy, what is the mood? I mean, you said Fort Myers was bustling as usual, but was there a sense of panic and urgency for those who had to leave? When you say it was manufactured homes, I mean, typically we think of, you know, maybe trailer parks or trailer homes, correct?
Right, right. So this was a trailer park. And you know, I do know some people in the area who have left. Some people have, one person has gone to Mississippi. I know I have friends in Tampa who are going to North Carolina. I know someone from here. They're pretty much, people are trying to get out of Dodge.
Speaking of which, Quincy, when are you getting out of Dodge? What about you? What are your plans and your colleagues? Will you all be safe?
Right. So we're planning on staying here for the storm. Right now, the plan is for me to be at Lee County's Emergency Operations Center, which is pretty safe. My colleagues will be here in the newsroom keeping everyone up to date, and if things get bad, luckily on campus there is an arena to evacuate to.
You mentioned when you went to the store there was, what did you say, Perrier water and caviar?
Correct.
Wow. Quincy Waters reporting on what's taking place in Lee County, Florida, from WGCU of Florida Gulf Coast University. Quincy, thanks for taking the time, but above all that, be safe.
Thank you so much, Rose.
My name is Hawa and I live in Claxton. One thing I like about Claxton is the diversity city, and there is like many other people come from other countries. I have a lot of friends from different backgrounds. Like Claxton feel like to me is like an immigration cello, like where some people from other country and you get to meet the friends and get to know other people from other nations. If I would change anything about Claxton, I would change like about the school where I go. Like we have to have a new building and new stuff like this.
From AtlantaPlanet.org, here's a look at some upcoming events. Stone Mountain Park's annual Yellow Daisy Festival is this weekend. More than 400 artists from around the country will be there. And the Atlanta Beltline Lantern Parade is Saturday night. It's on the East Side Trail and starts around 8:30. There's more online at AtlantaPlanet.org/festivals.
And that's it for today's edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Foxen. Our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer is Christine Dempsey. A big thanks to Dennis O'Hare today for helping us out. And a special thanks to the entire WAB News team, as well as our digital services crew. If you missed any of today's show, you can find the entire program online. You know where to go, wabe.org/closerlook. And you can now listen to Closer Look weeknights at 9 p.m. We're back this Sunday at 1. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's Choice for NPR.